You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. This is a reading of a selection of lectures by Rudolf Steiner from Collected Works 60 and 61, entitled Turning Points in Spiritual History by Rudolf Steiner, translated by Walter F. Knox. And Lecture 1 is entitled Zarathustra. And it was given in January 19th, 1911, in Berlin. Among the fundamental principles underlying spiritual science, and to which your attention has been drawn in previous lectures, the most prominent is the idea of reincarnation. According to this generally unpopular and little understood concept, it is maintained that human individuality is constrained to manifest again and again in a single personality during its unfoldment in the course of repeated earth lives. It has been pointed out previously that many and diverse questions are associated with this concept, and this will become more and more apparent as we proceed. What deep meaning, we might ask, underlies the fact that the span of a person's life on the earth is destined to recur not once only, but many times, and that during each successive period between rebirth and death, the human individuality persists? When we study the evolution of humankind in the light of spiritual science, we find therein a progressive meaning, a design of such nature that each age and each epoch presents in some fashion a different content. We realize that human evolution is ever destined to maintain a definite upward trend. Thus do we become aware of a profound latent significance when we know that the varied influences that act upon humankind are indeed potent and become absorbed ever, over and over again by the capital I during the course of human development. This is possible only because a person's essential being is brought into contact not once alone, but recurrently with the great living stream of evolution. When we regard the whole evolutionary process as a rational progression, ever accompanied by fresh contents, there dawns a true comprehension of those great spiritual beings who set the measure of progress. We are then able to realize the import and proper relationship of these outstanding leaders, from whom have come new thoughts, experiences, and impulses destined to further the advancement and progressive evolution of humanity. During this cycle of lectures, I shall speak of many such spiritual beings who have acted as guides to humankind, and at the same time bring forward and elucidate various matters connected with this subject. The first human individuality to claim our attention from such a point of view is Zarathustra, about whom little is known, though there is much discussion in these days. For, as far as external investigation goes, his history is especially difficult to fathom, as it is shrouded in mystery and unrecorded in ancient documents. When we consider the characteristics of such a personality as Zarathustra, whose gifts to humankind as far as they are preserved for us seem so strange to our present age, we at once realize how great is the dissimilarity in the human's whole being at different periods of earthly progress. Casual reflection might easily lead to the conclusion that from the very beginning, humanity has always had the same ideas concerning morality, the same general thoughts, feelings, and conceptions as those that exist in our time. From previous lectures, however, and from others that will follow, you will know through the teachings of spiritual science that during humankind's development great and important changes take place, especially with respect to the life of the human soul, the nature of human apprehension, emotions, and desires. Further, you will realize that humanity's consciousness was very differently constituted in olden days and that there is reason to believe that in the future yet other stages will be reached in which the conscious condition of humankind will vary considerably from its normal state today. When we turn our attention to Zarathustra, we find that we must look back over an extremely long period of time. According to certain modern researches, he is considered to be a contemporary of Buddha, the approximate date of his life being fixed at some 6 to 6.5 centuries before the birth of Christianity. It is, however, a remarkable and interesting fact that other investigators of late years, after carefully studying all existing traditions concerning Zarathustra, have been driven to the conclusion that the personality concealed beneath the name of the ancient founder of the Persian religion must have lived a great many centuries before the time of Buddha. Greek historians have stated over and over again that the period ascribed to Zarathustra should be put back very many years, possibly 5 to 6,000 years before the Trojan War, the date of which has been placed at about 1200 BCE. In this light, and from what has been learned through research in many directions, we can now feel certain that historical investigators will, in the end, be unwillingly forced to acknowledge that the claims of Grecian scholarship regarding the great antiquity of the Zarathustrian era, as indicated by ancient tradition, are justly founded and must be accepted as authentic. In its statements and theories, spiritual science fully concurs with the old Greek writers, who in olden days fixed the period of the founder of the Persian religion so far back in time. We have therefore good reason for maintaining that Zarathustra, living as he did thousands of years before the birth of Christianity, was doubtless confronted with a very different class of human consciousness from that which exists in our present age. It has often been pointed out, and we will again refer to this matter, that in ancient times the development of human consciousness was such that the old, quote, dream state, close quote, or clairvoyant condition, parenthesis, we will avoid misusing this term, as is so often done these days, close parenthesis, was in every way perfectly normal to human beings, so that their conceptions and ideas were such that they did not contemplate the world from that narrow perceptual point of view that is so prevalent today. We can best picture the impressions made by the world upon the consciousness of the ancients if we turn our thoughts to that last enduring remnant of the old clairvoyant state, namely dream consciousness. We all know those fluctuating dream pictures that come to us at times, the most of which carry no meaning, and are so often merely suggestive of the outer world, though there may now and then intrude some higher level of conscious thought. Dream visions, which at the present time we find so difficult to interpret and to understand. We might say that our sleep consciousness runs its course pictorially in ever-changing scenes, which are at the same time symbolic. For instance, many of us have had the experience that events connected with some impressive happening, say a conflagration, have been after a time once more figuratively manifested to us in a dream. Let us now consider for a moment this other horizon of our sleeping state, where clings in truth that last remnant of a conscious condition belonging to a bygone age in the gray and distant past. The consciousness of the ancients was such that in reality they lived in a life of imagery. The visions that came to them were not merely indefinite, unrelated creations, for they had reference to an actual outer world. In olden days, human beings were capable of intermediate conscious states between those that prevail when we sleep and when we are awake. Then it was that they lived in the presence of the spirit world, and the spirit world entered into their being. Today this door is closed, but in those ancient times such was not the case. It was while they were in this intermediate condition that humans became aware of visions that resembled, to some extent, dream pictures, but were definite in their manifestation of a spirit life and of spiritual achievement existing beyond the perceptual world. Although in the Zarathustrian era such visions had become somewhat confused and vague, there was nevertheless still close contact with the world of spirit. Thus these ancients could say from direct observation and experience, quote, "In the same way that I realize this outer physical world and this perceptual life, even so do I know that there exists another conscious condition belonging to a different region, a spiritual realm, related to that which is material, and where I do truly experience and observe the workings of the divine spirit." Close quote. It is a fundamental principle underlying the evolution of the human race that in no case can any one quality be developed except at the expense of some other attribute. Hence it came about that from epoch to epoch, the faculty through which in olden times humankind obtained a clear inner vision of the spiritual realms became less and less pronounced. Our present-day exact methods of thought, our power of expression, our logic, and all that we regard as the most important driving forces of modern culture did not exist in the remote past. Such faculties have been acquired during later periods at the expense of the old clairvoyant consciousness. And it is now for humankind to regain and cultivate this long-lost power. Then, in the future of human evolution, a time will come when, in addition to human beings' purely physical consciousness, intellectuality, and logic, they will again approach the condition of the ancient seer. We must differentiate between the upward and downward tendency of human consciousness. Evolution has a deeper meaning when we realize that in the beginning, human beings were entirely of a spiritual realm, where they lived in the soul. When they descended into the physical world, it was ordained that they should gradually relinquish clairvoyant power in order to acquire qualities born of the existing purely physical conditions, such as intellectuality and logic. When this stage in their development has run its course, human beings will again return to the world of spirit. Regarding the circumstances connected with these curious clairvoyant states and experiences of the ancients, we have no historical record. Zarathustra lived in that same remote age, and was one of those great leading personalities who gave immense stimulus to the advancement of culture and civilization. Such guiding personalities must ever draw from the creative source, that which we may term illumination, whereby they are initiated into the higher mysteries of the world, irrespective of the standard of normal human consciousness existing in their time. Other such outstanding personalities, of whom mention will be made during these lectures, are Hermes, Buddha, and Moses. Zarathustra lived at least 8,000 years before the present era, and those glorious gifts to civilization that emanated from his illumined spirit have been reflected in the great cultural progress of humanity. His influence has long ago been clearly recognized and can be detected even to this day by all who take note of the mysterious currents underlying the whole of human evolution. We now realize that Zarathustra belonged essentially to those great ones in whose souls lived a measure of the spiritual elements of truth, wisdom, and perception, far surpassing the customary standard of human consciousness of their period. His mission was to proclaim to his fellow human beings, in that part of the world later known as the Persian Empire, the grand truths that emanated from the super-perceptual regions, a world utterly beyond the apprehension of normal human consciousness, in that dim and distant age. If we would understand the true significance of Zarathustra's teachings, we must remember that it was his task to present to a certain section of humanity, in an intelligible manner, a particular world aspect. At the same time, various movements in progress among the peoples of other regions of the world had imparted a different trend to the whole sphere of human culture. The personality of Zarathustra is of special interest, because he lived in a territory contiguous upon its southern side to a country inhabited by Indian ethnic groups, upon whom spiritual blessings flowed in quite a different manner. When we look forward from those bygone times, we find upon the same soil where these ancient Indian groups lived, the peoples among whom, at a later period, arose the poets of the Vedas. To the north, where the great Brahman doctrine developed, is situated the region that was permeated throughout by the powerful and compelling teachings of Zarathustra. But that which he gave to the world was in many respects fundamentally different from the teachings of the great leaders among the Indians, whose words have lived on in the moving poetry of the Vedas and in their profound philosophy, and found an echo in that final glorious blaze of light, the revelation of the Buddha. We can understand the difference between that which was born of the flow of thought from Zarathustra and the teachings of the ancient Indians, when we bear in mind that we can approach the region of the super-perceptual world from two sides. In other lectures, we have spoken of the path that human beings must traverse in order to enter into the spirit realms. There are two possible methods by which they may raise the energy of their souls and the capacities latent in their inner beings so much above their normal level that they can pass out of this perceptual world into the super-perceptual world. First, human beings can retire more and more deeply into the soul and thus merge themselves in their very essence. The second method leads behind the veil spread around us by our material state. Human beings can enter the super-perceptual region by both these methods. When we experience within our very being a deepening of all values of our spiritual feelings, conceptions, and ideas, in short, of our soul impulses, and when, in fact, we creep more and more into ourselves so that our spiritual powers become ever stronger and stronger, then can we, in some mystic way, merge ourselves within and pass through all that we hold of the physical world to our actual spirit essence, to the soul, capital I, that continues from incarnation to incarnation and is not perishable but everlasting. When we have overcome our lusts and passions and all those experiences of the soul that are ours, because we are of the body in a physical world, then can our true being pierce the surrounding veil and forever enter the world of spirit. On the other hand, if we develop those powers that will enable us not merely to be sensible of the outer world, with its colors, tone sensations, heat and cold, and if we so strengthen our spiritual forces that we shall be aware of that which lies beyond the colors, the sound, the heat, and the cold, and all those other earthly sense perceptions that hang as a mist about us, then will the enhanced powers of our soul take us behind the enshrouding cloud and into that boundless super-perceptual region that is without confine and stretches ever into the infinite. There is one way leading to the spirit world that we may term the, quote, mystical method, close quote, and another that is properly called, quote, the method of spiritual science, close quote. All great spiritual personalities have followed these paths in order to attain to those truths and revelations that it was their mission to impress upon humanity in the form of cultural progress. In primeval times, the human being's development was of such a nature that great revelations could come only to the people of any particular race through one of these methods alone. But from that period in which the Greeks lived onward, that is, at the dawn of the Christian era, these two separate thought currents commingled and became more and more one single cultural stream. When we now speak of entering the higher spheres, we understand that those who would penetrate into the superperceptual region develop both qualities of power in the soul. The forces necessary to the mystical method are evolved within the inner being, and those essential to the course of spiritual science are strengthened while the human being is yet conscious of the outer world. There is today no longer any definite separation of these two paths, because these two currents have run their course together since about the time of that epoch marked by the life of the Grecian race. In the one, revelation comes about through a mystic merging of consciousness within a person's very being. In the other, the veil is torn asunder by the enhanced power of an individual's spiritual forces, and a person's awareness stretches outward into the great cosmos. In olden times, before the Grecian or Christian era, these two possible methods were in operation separately among different peoples, and we find them working in close proximity, but in diverse ways, in the Indian culture that found expression among the Vedas, on the one hand, and that of Zarathustra, further north, on the other. All that we look upon with such wonder in the ancient Indian culture, and that later found expression through Buddha, was achieved by inner contemplation and turning away from the outer world through causing the eyes to become less sensitive to physical colors and the ears to physical sounds, and bringing about a deadening of the sense organs in general to the perceptual veil, so that the inner soul forces might be strengthened. Thus did humanity press on to Brahma, there to feel unified with that which ever works and weaves as the inner spirit of the universe. In this way originated the teachings of the holy rishis, which live on in the poetry of the Vedas, in the Vedantic philosophy, and in Buddhism. The doctrine of Zarathustra was, however, entirely based upon the other method mentioned. He taught his disciples the secret of strengthening their powers of apprehension and cognition, that they might pass beyond the mists surrounding the outer perceptual world. He did not say to his followers, as did the Indian teachers, quote, "Turn away from the colors and from the sounds, and from all outer sense impressions, and seek the path to the spiritual realms only through the merging of yourselves within your very souls." Close quote. Instead, he spoke thus, quote, "Strengthen your powers of perception, so that you may look around upon all things, the plants, the animals, that which lives in the air and in the water, upon the mountains and in the depths of the valleys, and cast your eyes upon the world." Close quote. We know that the disciples of the Indian mystics regarded this earth upon which we live as merely Maya, illusion, and turned from it in order to attain to Brahma. On the other hand, Zarathustra counseled his followers not to draw away from the material world, but to pass outward and beyond it, so that they might say, quote, "Whenever we experience perceptual manifestations in the outer physical world, we realize that therein lie concealed and beyond our sense perceptions the workings and achievements of the Spirit." Close quote. It is remarkable that the two paths should have been thus united in early Grecian times. Just because in that period true spiritual knowledge was more profound than in our day, which we are inclined to regard as so amazingly enlightened, all things found expression in imagery, and the images gave rise to mythology. Thus do we find these two thought currents commingled and fostered in the Grecian culture, the mystical tending inward and the Zarathustrian outward into the great cosmos. That such was the case becomes evident from the fact that one of these paths was named after Dionysus, that mysterious God who was reached when human beings merged ever deeper and deeper within their inner being, there to find a questionable subhuman element, as yet unknown, and from which they first developed. It was this unclean and half-animal residue to which was given the name of Dionysus. On the other hand, all that comes to us when we regard our physical sense perceptions from a purely spiritual standpoint was termed Apollo. Thus in ancient Greece we find, side by side, in contrast, the teaching of Zarathustra in the Apollo current of thought and the doctrine of mystical contemplation in the Dionysus current. In Greece they united and operated conjointly, the Zarathustrian and the mystical methods, those methods that had been at their highest level yet working separately in the days of the ancient Indians. Here we might say that in olden times these two thought currents were destined to commingle in the coming Grecian cults of Apollo and Dionysus, and thenceforward they would continue as one, so that in our present cultural period, when we raise ourselves to a certain spiritual understanding, we find them still unified and enduring. It is very remarkable, and one of the many riddles that present themselves to the thinking mind, that Nietzsche, in his first work titled The Birth of Tragedy from the Spirit of Music, gave evidence of a vague suspicion that in the Grecian creeds of Dionysus and Apollo, the mystical current meets the stream of scientific spiritual thought. A further matter of interest lies in the fact that Zarathustra actually taught his disciples to recognize in detail the hidden workings of the spirit in all material things, and that from this starting point the whole of his gifts to culture emanated. He emphasized that it was not sufficient for humankind merely to say, quote, "There before us spreads a material world, behind which ever works and weaves the divine spirit." Close quote. Such a statement might appear at first sight full of significance, but it leads only to a general pantheistic outlook, and means nothing more than that some vague, nebulous spirit underlies all material phenomena. Zarathustra, like all other great personalities of the past, who were exalted and had direct contact with the spirit world, did not present these matters to his followers and the people in any such indefinite and abstract manner. He pointed out that in the same way as individual physical happenings vary in import, so is it with the latent spiritual factor, it being sometimes of greater and sometimes of lesser moment. He further stated that the sun, regarded purely from the physical point of view as a member of the stellar system, is the source of all earthly phenomena, life, and activity, while concealed within is the center of spiritual existence, insofar as we are immediately concerned. These things Zarathustra impressed earnestly and clearly upon his disciples. Using simple words, we can picture him as addressing them somewhat as follows, quote, "When you regard human beings, you must realize that they do not consist only of a material body. This is but an outer expression of the spirit that is within. Even as the physical covering is a manifestation, in condensed and crystallized form, of the true spiritual human being, so is the sun that appears to us as a light-giving mass, when considered as such, merely the external manifestation of an inner spiritual sun." Close quote. In the same way as we term the human spirit element, as distinguished from the physical, the aura, to use an ancient expression, so do we call the all-embracing, hidden spiritual part of the sun the great aura, Ahura Mazda, in contradistinction to the human being's spiritual component, which is sometimes called the little aura. Zarathustra named all that lies hidden within and beyond the human being's mere apprehension of the physical sun, Ahura Mazda, or Ahura Mazdao, and considered this element as important to our spiritual experiences and conditions, as is the physical sun to the well-being of plants and animals and all that lives upon the face of the earth. There, behind the physical sun, lies the spiritual master, the creator, Ahura Mazda, or Ahura Mazda. From Ahura Mazda came the name Ormuzd, or the spirit of light. While the Indians mystically searched their inner being to attain to Brahma, the eternal, who shines outward as a point of light from within the human essence, Zarathustra urged his disciples to turn their eyes upon the great periphery of existence, and pointed out that there, within the body of the sun, dwells the great solar spirit, Ahura Mazda, the spirit of light. He taught them that in the same way as human beings strive to raise their spirit to perfection, so must they ever battle against the lower passions and desires, against the delusive images suggested by possible deception and falsehood, and all those antagonistic influences within, which continually oppose spiritual impulses. Thus must Ahura Mazda face the opposition of the spirit of darkness, Angra Mainyus, or Ahriman. We can now realize how the great Zarathustrian conception could evolve from experiences born of sensations and sense contents. Through them, Zarathustra could advance his disciples to a point where he could make clear to them that within human beings there is a perfecting principle that tells them that whatever may be their present condition, this principle will work persistently within, and that through it they may raise ever higher and higher. At the same time, however, there also operates impulses and inclinations, deceit and falsehood, all tending toward imperfection. This perfecting principle must therefore be developed and expanded, so that the world may be destined to attain to wiser and more advanced states of perfection. It is the principle of Ahura Mazda, and it is assailed throughout the whole world of by Ahriman, the spirit of darkness, who through imperfection and evil brings shadows into the light. By following the method outlined, Zarathustra's disciples were enabled to realize and to feel that in truth each individual human being is an image of the outer universe. We must not seek the true significance of such teaching in theories, concepts, and ideas, but in active, vivid consciousness, and in the sensations impressed when through them human beings realize that they are so related to the universe that they can say, quote, "As I stand here, I am a small world, and as such I am a replica of the great cosmos," close quote. Just as we have within us a principle of perfection and another that is antagonistic, so throughout the universe is Ormuzd opposed by Ahriman. In these teachings, the whole cosmos is represented as typical of a widespread human being. The forces of greatest virtue are termed Ahura Mazda, while against these operate the powers of Angra Mainyus. When human beings realize that they are in direct contact with the workings of the universe and the attendant physical phenomena, but can apprehend only the perceptual, then as they begin to gain spiritual experience, a feeling of awe may come over them, especially if they are materialistic in thought, when they learn through spectrum analysis that the same matter that exists upon the earth is found in the most distant stars. It is the same with Zarathustrianism, when human beings feel that their spiritual part is merged in that of the whole cosmos, and that they have indeed emanated from its great spirit. Herein lies the true significance of such a doctrine, which was not merely abstract in character, but wholly concrete. In the present age, it is most difficult to make people understand even when they have a certain sense for the spiritual that lies behind the perceptual, that it is necessary to a true and spiritually scientific view of the cosmos that there be more than one central unity of spirit power. Even as we distinguish between the separate forces in nature, such as heat, light, and chemical forces, so in the world of spirit must we not merely recognize one centralized power, whose existence is not denied, but also differentiate between it and certain subservient, uplifting forces, whose spheres of action are more circumscribed than those of the all-embracing spirit. Thus it was that Zarathustra made a distinction between the omnipotent Ormuzd and those spirit beings by whom he was served. Before we turn to a consideration of these subservient spirit entities, we must draw attention to the fact that the Zarathustran theory was not a mere dualism, a simple doctrine of two worlds, the worlds of Ormuzd and of Ahriman, but that it maintained that underlying this double flux of cosmic influence is a definite unity, a single power, which gave birth to both the realm of light, Ormuzd, and the realm of darkness, Ahriman. It is not easy to gain a right understanding of Zarathustra's conception concerning this unity underlying Ormuzd and Ahriman. With reference to this point, the Greek authors state that the ancient Persians worshipped and regarded as a, quote, in quotes, living unity, that which lay beyond the light, and which Zarathustra termed Zervain Akarena. How can we gain a comprehension of what Zarathustra in his teachings meant by Zervain Akarena or Zaruwana Akarana? Let us consider for a moment the course of evolution. This we must regard as of such nature that all beings tend toward greater and greater perfection. If we look into the future, we see more and more of the radiance from the light realms of Ormuzd. But if we turn our eyes upon the past, we realize how the powers of Ahriman, which oppose Ormuzd, are there. We then know that with the passing of time, these powers must be conquered and forever ended. We will now picture to ourselves that the path into the future and the path into the past each lead to the same point, the conception that present-day human beings find most difficult to grasp. Let us take as an example a circle. If we pass along the circumference from the lowest point in one direction, we come to the opposite point above. If, however, we continue along the other side, we come to the point at which we started. When we consider a larger circle, then the circumference is less curved, and we must traverse a greater distance in each case. We will now suppose that the circle expands ever more and more. Ultimately, the path on either side becomes a straight line and is infinite. But just before the circle becomes infinite, we would reach the same point whether we went by the one path or the other. Why, then, should not the same happen when the circumference is so expanded that the periphery becomes a straight line? In this case, the point at infinity on the one must be identical with that on the other, and therefore we must be able to travel to it from the lowest point in one sense, say positive, and return as if coming from the other negative direction. This means that when our conception is infinite, we have a straight line extending without limit on either side, but which is in reality the circumference of an infinite circle. The abstraction given here lies at the basis of Zarathustra's conception of what he termed Zaruwana Akarana. Here, with regard to time, we look in one direction into the future, and in the other into the past. When we consider an infinite period, time closes in upon itself as in a circle. This self-contained and infinite time circle is symbolically represented as a serpent eternally biting its own tail. And into it is woven, upon the one side, the power of light, shedding upon us continually a greater and greater radiance, and upon the other the power of darkness, becoming ever more and more profound. When we are midway, then is the light, Ormuzd, intermingled with the shadows, Ahriman. All is interwoven in the self-embracing infinite flux of time, Zarawana, Akarana. There is something more about this ancient cosmic conception. Its basic ideas were treated seriously. There were no mere vague statements such as this, quote, without and remote from all that is material is this perceptual world. Beyond those things that affect our eyes, our ears, and our sense organs in general, abides the spirit. Close quote. It was definitely asserted that in everything that could be seen and apprehended could be discerned something of the nature of spirit signs or a manifestation of the spirit world. If we take a sheet of paper upon which are inscribed alphabetical characters, we may combine the characters into words, but we must first have learned how to read. Without this ability, no one could read about Zarathustra, for they would merely perceive certain characters that could only be followed with the eyes. Actual reading can take place only after it is clearly understood how to connect such characters with that which is within the soul. Zarathustra discerned a written sign underlying all that was in the perceptual world, particularly in the manner in which the stars are grouped in the universe. Just as we recognize certain characters upon paper, so did Zarathustra descry on the starry firmament something similar to letters, conveying a message from the spirit world. Hence arose an art of penetrating into the world of spirit, of deciphering the signs indicated by the arrangement of the stars, and of finding a method of reading and construing from their movements and order in what manner and way those spiritual beings that are without inscribe the facts concerning their activities in space. Zarathustra and his disciples had a paramount interest in these matters. To them it was a most important sign that Ahura Mazda, in order to accomplish his creations and to reveal his message to the world, should, in the language of modern astronomy, quote, describe a circular path, close quote. This fact was regarded as a sign traced in the heavens that indicated the manner in which Ahura Mazda worked and the relation that his activities bore to the universe as a whole. It is important that Zarathustra was able to point out that the constellations of the zodiac, taken together as forming a closed curve in space, should symbolize a continuous and also retroactive time flux. We can realize that there is indeed a most profound significance underlying the statement that one branch of this time curve stretches outward into the future, while the other leads backward into the remote past. Zarawana Akarana is that bright band of stars later known as the zodiac, that self-contained timeline ever traversed by Ormuzd, the spirit of light. In other words, the passage of the sun across the constellations of the zodiac is an expression of the activity of Ormuzd, while the zodiac itself is the symbol of Zarawana Akarana. In reality, Zarawana Akarana and the zodiac are identical terms, in the same way as are Ormuzd and Ahura Mazda. There are two special circumstances to be considered in this connection. First, there is the passage of the sun through the zodiac that takes place while it is light, as in the summer. At such time, the solar radiance falls full upon the earth, bringing with it the power emanating from those spiritual forces ever flowing outward from the light realms of Ormuzd. That part of the zodiac traversed by Ahura Mazda in the daytime or during the summer denotes the manner in which he works and weaves unhindered by Ahriman. On the other hand, those zodiacal constellations that lie far beneath the horizon, dark regions through which we might picture the passage of Angra Mainyus, are symbolic of the kingdom of the shadows. We have stated that Zarathustra regarded Ormuzd as associated with the bright sections of the zodiac, Zarawana Akarana, while he looked upon Ahriman as connected with the gloom. In what way do the activities of Ormuzd and Ahriman find expression in our material world? In order to understand this point, we must realize that the effect of the solar rays is different in the morning from that at noon, varying as the sun ascends from Aries to Taurus, and again during its descent toward the horizon. The influence exerted is not the same in winter as in summer, and differs with every passing sign of the zodiac. Zarathustra regarded the changing aspects of the sun in connection with the zodiacal constellations as symbolic of the activities of Ormuzd, proceeding from different directions, and from which came those spiritual beings that are both his servants and his sons, and who are ready at all times to execute his commands. These are the Amshaspans, or Ameshas Pentas, subservient entities to each of whom is allotted some special duty. While Ormuzd controls all active functions in the light realms, the Amshaspans undertake that specific work which finds expression in the transmission of the sun's light when it is in Aries, Taurus, Cancer, and so on. But the true vital activity of Ormuzd is manifested in the full radiance of the sun, shining throughout all bright signs of the zodiac from Aries to Libra or Scorpio. Following the Zarathustrian line of thought, we might say, quote, "It is as though the evil powers of Ahriman came through the earth from those dark regions where abide his servants, his own Amshaspans, who are opposed to the good genie standing by the side of Ormuzd." Close quote. Zarathustra actually distinguished 12 different subservient spirit entities, 6 or 7 on the side of Ormuzd and 5 or 6 on that of Ahriman. These are regarded as typical of good or evil genii, Amashas Pentas, lower spirits, according to whether their influence comes from the sun's rays, from the bright signs of the zodiac, or emanates from those that are in gloom. Goethe had the subservient spirits of Ormuzd in mind when he wrote the following words at the beginning of Faust and the Prologue of Heaven. Quote, "But ye, God's sons in love and duty, enjoy the rich, the ever-living beauty, creative power that works eternal schemes. Clasp you in bonds of love, relaxing never, and what in wavering apparition gleams, fix in its place with thoughts that stand forever." Close quote, translated by Bayard Taylor. Let me give the German a try. Doch ihr die echten Göttersöhne, erfreut euch der lebendig reichen Schöne, das Werdende, das ewig wirkt und lebt, umfass euch mit der Liebe holden Schranken, und was in schwankender Erscheinung schwebt, befestiget mit dauernden Gedanken. End of footnote. It is apparent in this passage that the conception which Goethe formed of, in quotes, God's sons, as the servants of the highest divine power, is similar to Zarathustra's concept concerning the Amshaspans, of which he recognized, as noted, 12 different kinds. Again, subservient to these Amshaspan entities, according to Zarathustrianism, are still lower orders of spiritual powers or forces, among which some 28 separate types are usually distinguished. These are the so-called Izarads or Izeds. The number of different classes into which they may be divided is, however, indeterminate, being variously estimated from 24 to 28 and even as high as 31. There is yet a third division of spiritual powers or forces, termed by Zarathustra Feruhars or Fra-Hashars. According to our conceptions, the Faruhars have the least influence of any upon our tendencies and dispositions in the material world, and are regarded as that spiritual element which permeates the great macrocosm and underlies all perceptual physical activity. They are the reality behind everything of which we are conscious, and appears to us as merely external and material. While we picture the Amshaspans as controlling the 12 forces at work during all physical effects, engendered by the action of light, and the Izeds as governing those that influence the animal kingdom, so do we consider the Feruhars, in addition to possessing the quality mentioned earlier, as spiritual entities, having under their guidance the group souls of animals. Thus did Zarathustra discern a specialized realm beyond this perceptual universe, a perfectly organized super-perceptual world, and his concept was absolutely definite and in no sense an abstraction. Behind Ormuzd and Ahriman, he pictured Zarawana Akarana, then the good and bad Amshaspans, below them the Izeds, and last the Feruhars. The human being is a replica in miniature of the great universe, and therefore all forces operative in the cosmos must be present in some manner within each person's being. Just as the benevolent powers of Ormuzd are expressed during that inner struggle to attain to perfection, and the unclean forces of Ahriman are in evidence when there is gloom and temptation, so do we find also the trace of other spiritual powers, those of the lower genii. I will now make a definite statement, which, when viewed from the standpoint of modern cosmic ideas, is liable to awaken bitter feeling. I assert that before long it will be discovered and recognized by external science that a super-perceptual element underlies all physical phenomena, and that latent spirit exists in everything that comes within the limits of our sense perceptions. Further, science will be driven to admit that in the physical structure of human beings there is much that is a counterpart of those forces that permeate and spread life throughout the whole universe, and which flow into the body, there to become condensed. Let us go back to the Zarathustrianism doctrine, which in many ways is similar to that of spiritual science. According to its concepts, Ormuzd and Ahriman are regarded as influencing humankind from without, Ormuzd being the source of inward impulses toward perfection, while Ahriman is ever in opposition. The Amshaspans also exert spiritual activity. If we consider their forces as being, so to speak, condensed in the human being, then it should be possible to trace and recognize their action to the point of physical expression. In Zarathustra's time, anatomy, as we understand it today, did not exist. Zarathustra and his disciples, by means of their spiritual insight, actually saw the cosmic streams to which reference has been made. They appeared to them in the form of 12 cosmic outpourings flooding in upon the human being, there to maintain activity. Thus it came about that the human head was regarded by Zarathustra's followers as a symbol of the inflowing of the 7 good and 5 evil Amshaspans. Within the human being, we have a continuance of the Amshaspand flux. How then is this flux to be recognized at this much later period? The anatomist has discovered that there are 12 principal pairs of brain nerves, which pass from the brain into the body. These are the physical counterparts, as it were, of the 12 condensed Amshaspand outflowings, namely 12 pairs of nerves of extreme potency in bringing about either the highest perfection or the greatest evil. Here then we find reappearing in our present age, but transformed into material terms, that concept which had come to Zarathustra from the spirit world and which he preached to his disciples. There is, however, in all this a point of controversy. it is so easy for anyone in our day to maintain that the statements of spiritual science become wholly fantastic, when it is alleged that Zarathustra, speaking of 12 amshaspans, had in mind something connected with the 12 pairs of nerves in the human head. But the time will come when the world will gain yet another item of knowledge, for it will be discovered in what manner and form the spirit, which permeates and lives throughout the universe, continues to be active in human beings. The old Zarathustrianism has arisen once again in our modern physiology. For in the same way as the 28 to 31 izeds are the servants of the amshaspans, so are the 28 spinal nerves subordinate to those of the brain. Again, the izeds, who are present in the outer universe as a spirit flux, enter the human body, and their sphere of action is in those nerves that stimulate the lower soul life of the human being. In these nerves they crystallize, as it were, and assume a condensed form. Where the izid flux as such entirely ceases, and the term, in quotes, nerve, can no longer be applied, is the actual center where our personality receives its crowning touch. Further, those of our thoughts that rise slightly above mere cognition and simple brain action are typical of the Ferohars. Our present period is connected in a remarkable manner with the doctrine of Zarathustra. Through his teachings and by means of his spiritual archetypes, Zarathustra was able to enlighten his people regarding those regions that spread beyond the perceptual world, while his imagery was ever a flowing contact with that which lies hidden behind the veil. With reference to this great doctrine, it is most significant that after it had acted as an inspiration to humanity for a long period, always tending to promote greater and greater effort in various directions of cultural progress, only to lose its influence from time to time, there should arise once more in our day a marked tendency toward a mystical current of thought. It was the same with the Greeks after the two methods of approach to the spirit world had commingled, for they also, at times, showed a preference for either the mystical or the spiritual scientific thought current. It is owing to the modern predominating interest in mysticism that many people find themselves drawn toward the Indian spiritual science or method of contemplation. Hence it is that the most essential and deeply significant aspects of Zarathustrianism, in fact its very essence, hardly appear in the spiritual life of our time, though there is abundant evidence of the nature of Zarathustra's concepts and his methods of thought. But all that lies at the very base and is absolutely vital to his doctrine is in a sense lost to our age. When once we realize that in Zarathustrianism is contained the spiritual prototype of so many things that we have rediscovered in the domain of physical research, parenthesis, numerous examples of which might be quoted, close parenthesis, and of others that will be rediscovered later, then will a fundamental chord in our culture give place to one that will be founded upon the old Zarathustran teachings. It is remarkable that the profound attention Zarathustrianism paid to macrocosmic phenomena caused the world to recede, as it were, or appear of less moment, while in nearly all other beliefs with which a flood of mystical culture is associated, the outer world plays an important part. This is also the case in our present-day materialism. That great fundamental concept concerning two opposing basic qualities, which recurs again and again throughout the religious doctrines of the world, we regard in the following manner. We consider it as symbolized by the antithesis of the sexes, the male and the female, so that in the old religious systems founded upon mysticism, the gods and goddesses were in reality antithetical symbols of two opposing currents that flow throughout the universe. It is amazing that the teachings of Zarathustra should rise above these conceptions and picture the origin of spiritual activity in so different a manner, portraying the good as the resplendent and the evil as the shadows. Hence the chaste beauty of Zarathustrianism and its nobility, which transcends all those petty ideas that play so ugly a part in our time, when any endeavor is made to deepen the human being's conception of spiritual life. Where the Greek writers state that the supreme deity, in order to create Ormuzd, must also create Ahriman, so that Ormuzd should obtain an antithesis, then, in the opposition of Ahriman and Ormuzd, we have an example of how one primordial force is conceived as set against another. This same idea finds expression in the Hebrew, where evil comes upon the world through the woman, Eve. But we find nothing in Zarathustrianism concerning ills that the world suffered through the antithesis of the sexes. All those hateful ideas that are disseminated throughout our daily literature, pervading our very thoughts and feelings, and distorting the true significance of the phenomena of disease and health, while failing to comprehend the intrinsic facts of life, will disappear when that wholly different concept, the antithesis exhibited by Ormuzd and Ahriman, a conception so lofty and so powerful when compared with present-day paltry notions, is once more voiced in the words of Zarathustra and permeates and influences our modern culture. In this world all things pursue their appointed course, and nothing can hinder the ultimate triumph of Zarathustran conceptions, which will, little by little, insinuate themselves into the life of the people. When we look upon Zarathustra in this way, we realize that he was indeed a spirit who in bygone times brought potent impulses to bear upon human culture. That such was the case becomes evident if we but follow the course of subsequent events that took place in Asia Minor and later among the people of Assyria and Babylonia on down to the Egyptian period and further even to the time of the spreading of Christianity. Everywhere we find in different lines of thought something that may be traced back and shown to have its origin in that great light that Zarathustra set blazing for humanity. We can now understand how it was that a certain Greek writer who wished to emphasize the fact that some among the leaders had always given their people instruction in matters that they would require only at a later period in their culture, should have stated that while Pythagoras had obtained all the knowledge that he could from the Egyptians concerning the methods of geometry, from the Phoenicians concerning arithmetic, and from the Chaldeans concerning astronomy, he was forced to turn to the successors of Zarathustra to learn the secret teachings regarding the relation of humanity to the spirit world, and to obtain a true understanding of the proper conduct of life. The writer who made these statements regarding Pythagoras further asserts that the Zarathustrianism method for the conduct of life leads us beyond antitheses, and that all antitheses can be considered as culminating in the one great contrast of good and evil, which opposing condition can finally be absorbed only by the purging away of all evil, falsehood, and deceit. For instance, the worst enemy of Ormuzd is regarded as that one who bears the name of calumny, and calumny is one of the outstanding characteristics of Ahriman. The same writer states that Pythagoras failed to find the purest, the ideal ethical practice, namely the one directed toward the moral purification of the human being, among the Egyptians, the Phoenicians, or the Chaldeans, and that he had again to turn to Zarathustra's successors to acquire that lofty conception of the universe which leads humankind to the earnest belief that through self-purification alone may evil be overcome. Thus did the great nobility and oneness of Zarathustra's teachings become recognized among the ancients. We would here mention that the statements made in this lecture are supported in every case by independent historical research, and we should carefully weigh all assertions coming from representatives of other sciences and judge for ourselves whether or not they are in accord with our fundamental concepts. For instance, take the case of Plutarch, when he said that, in the sense of Zarathustrianism, the essence of light, as it affects the earth, is regarded as of supreme loveliness, and that its spiritual counterpart is truth. Here is a definite statement made by an ancient historian that is in complete agreement with all that has been said. We shall also find, as we proceed, that many historical events become clear and understandable when we take into consideration the various factors to which we have drawn attention. Let us now go back to the ancient Vedantic conception. This was based upon the mystical merging of human beings within their very being. But before they can attain to the inner light of Brahma, they must meet with and pass through those passions and desires that are induced by wild semi-human impulses within, and which are opposed to that mystical withdrawal within the spirit soul, and into the eternal inner being. The Indians came to the conclusion that this could be accomplished only if, pending mystic merging in Brahma, they could successfully eliminate all that we experience in the perceptual world that stimulates sensuous desires and allures through colors and through sounds. So long as these sensations play a part during our meditations, so long do we keep within us an enemy opposed to our mystical attainment to perfection. The Indian teacher said, quote, "Put away from yourselves all that can enter the soul through the powers that are external. Merge yourselves solely within your very being. Descend to the devas. And when you have vanquished the lower devas, then you will find yourselves within the kingdom of the deva of Brahma. But shun the realm of the asuras, whence come those malignant ones who would thrust themselves upon you from the outer world of Maya. From all such you must turn away, whatsoever may befall." Zarathustra, on the other hand, spoke to his disciples after this fashion, quote, "Those who follow the leaders among the people of the south can make no advance along the path they have chosen because of the different order of their search after those things that are of the spirit. In such manner can no nation make headway. The call is not alone to mystic contemplation and to dreaming, but to live in a world that provides freely of all that is needful. Humanity's mission lies with the art of agriculture and the promotion of civilization. You must not regard all things as merely Maya, but you must penetrate that veil of colors and of sounds that is spread around you, and avoid everything that may be of the nature of the devas, and which, because of your inner egoism, would hold you in its grasp. The region wherein abide the lower asuras must be traversed, though this you must force your way even up to the highest. But since your being has been especially organized and adapted to this intent, you must ever shun the dark realms of the devas." Close quote. In India, the teaching of the rishis was otherwise, for they said to their followers, quote, "Your beings are not suitably organized to seek that which lies within the kingdom of the asuras. Therefore avoid this region and descend to that of the devas." Close quote. Such was the difference between the Indian and Persian culture. The Indian peoples were taught that they must shun the asuras and regard them as evil spirits, because through the method of their culture they were aware only of the lower asuras. On the other hand, the Persians, who found only low types of devas in the devas regions, were adjured by their leaders thus, quote, "Enter the kingdom of the asuras, for you are so constituted that you may attain even unto the highest of them." There lay within the impulse that Zarathustra gave to humankind a great fervor, which found expression when he said, quote, "I have a gift to bestow upon humanity that shall endure and live throughout the ages, and will smooth the upward path, overcoming all false doctrines, which are but obstacles diverting human beings from their struggle toward the attainment of perfection." Close quote. Thus did Zarathustra feel himself to be the servant of Ahura Mazda, and as such he experienced personally the opposition of Ahriman, over whose principles his teachings should enable humankind to achieve a sweeping victory. This conviction he expressed in impressive and beautiful words, to which reference is found in ancient documents. These, however, were necessarily inscribed at a later date. But what spiritual science tells us concerning Zarathustra and his pronouncements comes from other sources. Throughout all his telling, adjurations, there rings forth the inner impulse of his mission, and we feel the power of that great passion that overcame him when, as the opponent of Ahriman and the principle of darkness, he said, quote, I will speak. Draw nigh and listen unto me, ye that come with longing from afar, and ye from near at hand. Mark my words. No more shall he, the evil one, this false teacher, conquer the spirit of good. Too long hath his vile breath bemingled human voice and human speech. But now I will denounce him in the words that the Highest, the First One, has put into my mouth, the words that Ahura Mazda has spoken. To him who will not hearken unto my words, and who will not heed that which I say unto you, to him will come evil, and that ere ever the world hath ended its cycles. Close quote. Thus spoke Zarathustra, and we can but feel that he had something to impart to humanity, which would leave its impress throughout all later cultural periods. Those among us who have understanding and will pay attention to that which persists in our time, even if it is only dimly apparent, those who will note with spiritual discernment the tenor of our culture, can even yet, after thousands of years, recognize the echo of the Zarathustran teachings. Hence it is that we number Zarathustra among great leaders, such as Hermes, Buddha, Moses, and others, about whom we shall have much to say in subsequent lectures. The spiritual gifts possessed by these great ones, and the position they occupied among human beings, are indicated and fitly expressed in the following words, quote, God sends us spirits that shine as stars from the spheres of eternal love. May we behold that glorious light they reflect from the realms above. Close quote. Footnote, an attempt at the German. Es leuchten gleich Sternen am Himmel des ewigen Seins, die gottgesandten Geister. Gelingen möge es allen Menschenseelen im Reiche des Erdenseins zu schauen ihrer Flammenlicht. End of footnote, the end of lecture 1.